Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On this day in 1977, August the 12th, Stephen Biko was arrested. He was arrested the other week, was died on this day, was arrested at Roblox and detained in prison. His torture and beating culminated in his being driven naked 700 miles to Pretoria in chains in a police van where he died on this day, September the 12th. And Jimmy Kruger, who was then the police minister of South Africa, said, "I'm not pleased, nor am I sorry, because death leaves me cold." And Stephen Biko was the leader, founder of, never part of the ANC, but of the Black Consciousness Movement among young people throughout South Africa. And he was a person, was a force, a moral force, a political force, a revolutionary force. And many people do not really know really what he stood for, who he was, what that Black Consciousness Movement meant, and what he meant, and what he can mean now and to the future, not just to South Africa, but to the world. So we're going to talk about the legacy of Stephen Biko this hour with three really remarkable guests that join us all from South Africa. We are joined by Dr. Kolela Manku, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Cape Town and an Oppenheimer Fellow at the Hutchins Center at Harvard University. He's the author of the most amazing book, Biko: A Life, which is the first full-length biography of Stephen Biko. Adrian Lowe is the program integrator for Africa's oldest community radio station, Bush Radio 89.5 FM, and he served as the media liaison for the Parliament of the Republic of South Africa from 1999 to 2001. And Dr. Rosanna Mart, who is director of the Center for Critical Research on Race and Identity at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all here on the Mark Steiner Show to talk about Stephen Biko.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And we want to have you all join us here at 410-319-8888. You can email your thoughts to us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet at Mark Steiner, and comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. You want to hear your thoughts, 410-319-8888, as we explore the life of Stephen Biko. And Dr. Kolela Manku, let me start here. I think that there are a lot of people who may have heard the name Stephen Biko, saw the movie Cry of Freedom that Richard Attenborough did with Denzel Washington when he played Biko.
That's right.
And we hear this name, but many people just don't know the essence of who this man was, what he meant at that time, and who he was as a human being. And would you start us off with that, just to kind of paint the picture of this man? We hear the name, but don't understand the depth of him.
Well, thanks for that, actually. I mean, the best way I can do this in broad outlines is kind of draw a comparison, actually, with the United States, with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. You know, you could say, and again, I'm providing very broad outlines here, that if Nelson Mandela was our Martin Luther King Jr., Steve Biko would have been our Malcolm X. And so he came onto the scene in the late 1960s within the context globally and in the United States of the rise of Black power and Black consciousness and those ideologies and philosophies, of course, had come out of people like Frantz Fanon on the African continent. So Steve came onto the scene. He was a student at the University of Natal. There was no political organization that was operating legally and openly in South Africa at that time, because the main organizations had been banned, which were the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress. And for about, you know, the whole decade of the 1960s, or the better part of it, there was no political organization for Black people. And this group of students, led by Steve Biko, decided that they were going to do something about that, to revive political activity and opposition to apartheid in the Black community, because there was this political lull throughout the community, and they felt they needed to do something. But as I say, they emerged at a time when the dominant philosophy in the Black world was that of Black power, and so Biko was influenced in many, many ways by that discourse of Black consciousness and Black power. And what he did, of course, together with, because they realized that as students, there was very little they could do to change the structure or to organize society. So what they did was to set out into the community, and they built a number of structures and organizations in the community, which ultimately led to the birth of the Black Consciousness Movement as a political movement throughout the 1970s.
And talk about the writing of this book for you before we turn to other guests. I mean, and what and the biography that you wrote, and what pushed you to do it, and what your relationship was around that.
Well, you know, I grew up knowing Steve. I mean, I was much younger, but our families have always been, you know, they go back a long, long way, and so I witnessed, you know, his activities as a child. I used to go along with him to some of his projects, throughout my life, I think I felt that I needed to do something, maybe something of a catharsis, about somebody who had been removed from my life when I was very, very young, and somehow I have been obsessed with his life. I mean, I was 11 years old when he was killed. But throughout my political and intellectual life, he has been the center of my work. And I think it's partly an attempt to reconcile with that loss that happened decades ago. And but I've turned it into a political and into an intellectual career. And there was no biography of Biko. And I told myself that's what I would do, and that's exactly what I did in writing this particular biography, Biko, A Life.
And it's very important, because I do want to explore how, in many ways, he's gotten lost by many, and we'll talk a bit about how he's being resurrected as well in many ways. And we're looking forward to having Rosanna Mart join us. We're trying to connect with her by phone right now, and she's trying to connect with us so we can get her voice on here as well. But Adam Lowe, welcome to the show. Adrian Lowe, welcome to the show. I'm glad you could join us as well. Good to have you here. We've had a number of people from Bush Radio on over the years, so it's good to have you here with us.
Thank you.
So, talk a bit about what his legacy means right now when you're doing your programming at Bush Radio.
Yeah, I when I was invited to be part of the interview, I actually spoke to a lot of the young people at Bush Radio. I'm privileged to work with a number of born frees. And I fear sometimes that the legacy of Biko is lost in some way with some of the young people. We even did a vox pop, and many people in the street, many of the young people were, is that an actor? He's a movie star. He was Mandela's brother. Those were some of the responses we got, which was quite shocking. So, you know, in some ways we are concerned that the legacy of Biko is being lost. But it is important, as you've mentioned, that is reclaimed. And like the book, the biography which is being written, we need to start celebrating our heroes, because it is more important that we use Biko as a symbol and as an icon for a lot of the young people who now, some of them who do seem a bit lost in South Africa.
I was reading a lot about the whole notion of the whole idea of born frees, and for our listeners, born frees are the is what people in South Africa call the young people who were born after the end of apartheid. And the downfall of apartheid. So for our listeners here in America to understand who the born frees are, who this young generation is, and 410-319-8888 is the number here. And I think, you know, Kalela, when we hear that, I mean, I think, what do you think happened? I mean, why, you know, when Stephen Biko was such a powerful figure in the anti-apartheid movement, he never joined the African National Congress, he was not part of the ANC, he was independent in his Black Consciousness Movement, which we'll explore in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so he was this pivotal figure, and everybody who was alive then knew who he was and mourned his death and made the revolution in his name in many ways. What happened, do you think, that he became so lost in our history?
Well, he was a victim of the ideological you know, warfare that took place in the black community. And of course, this ideological warfare was between the black consciousness and the ANC people on the other side. And then, of course, the ANC became the victors. You know, they were the victors in the end, and they formed the government. And they literally wrote Biko out of the script.
Why? Do you think? What was the struggle?
It's the most mind-boggling question. I mean, the guy is dead. You know, he's been dead for like decades. But to this day, they will not embrace or talk about Biko. So you have a situation in South Africa where Biko, you know, where he's talked about or where there have been initiatives, it's initiatives that have taken place in civil society, as initiatives that, you know, I and other people have done. But in terms of a governmental recognition of Biko, there is nothing. And it boggles the mind. And it speaks, though, I would imagine, to a sense of insecurity on the part of the ANC leadership. That, you know, somehow, if the discourse of Biko were to be brought onto the scene, that would upset, if you like, whatever arrangement had been arrived at, you know, in the negotiations to freedom. Whatever, there was always a feeling that we need to nurse our white people. We need to make sure that they are not challenged philosophically and otherwise. And Biko's black consciousness was exactly that kind of direct questioning of all these assumptions and taken for granted notions of white supremacy. So there is, ironically, a sense in which South Africa remains, because of this denial of Biko and because of this elision of Biko from our national culture, South Africa remains culturally in the past. It's still a very, very sort of white, dominated, culturally speaking and economically speaking, society. And that has a lot to do with the fact that Biko's discourse was just taken out. And so, for example, you have, I mean, I'll just quote two statistics that I often use when I speak in South Africa to illustrate this. Black professors in South Africa are only 3%.
Today, now?
Now. This is 20 years.
3%?
3%. Okay, of all the professors in our universities, 3%, right? That's the first statistic.
Wow.
The second statistic is that not a single book, not one book, has been written by a black South African about Nelson Mandela in the past 25 years.
That's so hard to it's counterintuitive. It's almost unfathomable to wrestle with that. We have to take a very quick break. Dr. Kliga Manku and Adrian Lowe, and we're also joined now by Dr. Rosanna Mart. I'm glad we finally got through and our phones work. So we're going to come right back with our three guests as we explore Stephen Biko. We are going to break with a tribute to Stephen Biko by Taba Zuki. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Biko was a great liquor leader. Biko never trouble no one. Biko always teach us to love and give. Biko never teach us to fight. But same way they kill Marcus Yavi. Same way they kill Martin Luther King. Same way they kill Paul Boger.
That music is the great Max Roach, Tears for Johannesburg, from his album We Insist, the Freedom Now Suite, that he composed, an album celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation and the freedom struggles in South Africa that came out in 1963. We are here with Adrian Lowe, the program integrator for Africa's oldest community radio station project, Bush Radio 89.5 FM, served as the media liaison for the Parliament of the Republic of South Africa 1999 to 2001. And as we were going to break, we were talking, who's still with us, Dr. Kolela Manku, who is assistant professor, associate professor of sociology at the University of Cape Town, an Oppenheimer fellow now at the Hutchins Center at Harvard University, who wrote Biko: A Life, the first full-length biography of Stephen Biko. And Dr. Rosanna Mart joins us. She is director of the Center for Critical Research on Race and Identity at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And we go back. I'm glad to glad we finally connected, Rosanna. That's good that you're here. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. You can also write to me at talk@steinershow.org. Rosanna, I'm glad we got through. I've been reading a great deal about what you've been writing and talking about as well. And I want to spend a moment with the three of you, starting with you, defining what this Black consciousness movement meant to Stephen Biko, as we kind of talk about what its relevance is for today's world. But let's talk a bit about what that movement meant.
Okay, is it my turn to go?
It is, Rosanna.
Okay, all right. I was about 13, 14 when I was at Steenbergen High School in Cape Town, which is sort of, in those days still and still today, part of a kind of colored community. I call myself Black and colored, which is my ethnicity. And at our school, because, you know, distributing pamphlets with Steve Biko's name on it was illegal, I come from the old slave district, which is District 6, and we were forcibly removed in 1973, along with several thousands of people. About 250,000 people were moved from District 6 over a 12-year period. And so for me as a young student to come, a young teenager coming from a background where we'd been forcibly removed and coming to a kind of understanding of what these words on the pamphlet meant completely changed my life, and it will forever be the one and only thing that changed my life, to the point where, you know, when you come from that kind of history and you're reading words like, you know, what does it mean to call yourself Black, the importance of mind, the importance of understanding that what the oppressor has tried to do was colonize you through your mind. And I think, you know, considering that I was a teenager, that I had just started high school, that I got to know of the words of Steve Biko, it was not something that, you know, teachers taught like many other aspects of African history. I think I grew up in that generation that became, you know, very much the protest politics, pavement politics generation that grappled with the whole question of the importance of mind, the importance of language, the importance of naming who the agents were of the system of white domination. I mean, Biko makes it very clear it's not white people individually that he has an issue with. It is about agency, and it's about looking at the agent, and it's about recognizing who the beneficiaries are of white domination. And Biko talks very much about logic. You know, he asks these white liberals in NUSAS, how can you tell me that I'm a racist, that I want to steer student politics in a particular way when we don't have representation, when you still think it's your place to tell me as a Black man how to liberate myself? So, I mean, I think that particular period of the 70s and the 80s, obviously Biko was murdered in 1977, killed the night of the 11th into the 12th. And so for my generation, we are the generation that was schooled on Black consciousness in very particular ways. We took it to our high school work. We took it to pavement politics. We took it to protest politics. And we also utilize it in terms of our scholarly work. I am the first person in my family to finish high school, let alone go to university. Now, in terms of your latter question, what is the significance of Biko today? I think 20 years after the first democratic elections, our students are very disgruntled. I'm sure you've all heard the news. We've had protests here last week. Registration has gone up. Fees have gone up. And so we also see at most universities, as I think I caught a snippet of what the previous speaker had said, just in terms of percentages of Black professors that are in our universities, you know, it is a huge problem. When I first joined the university, it was 2011 in May, I was very shocked to find out that our young generation, which South Africans call the born freeze, which is those born 1994 and after, didn't know who Steve Biko was. And so we make huge efforts. Certainly I have comrades and colleagues who make a huge effort to make sure that we have a BICO Day, that we teach these BICOs work, that we also look at relationships to Fanon, to Cabral, to Aimé Césaire, to other African scholars, to the Nadal sisters, Wangari Maathai. I can go on. But the significance that it holds today is basically the recognition of his analysis of the history of South Africa, his analysis of the importance of understanding how the system of white domination operates, his understanding of how capitalism operates in South Africa. We've seen that now with Marikana. We've seen that with the explosion of events around the Lonmin mines, of people like Cyril Ramaphosa, you know, who has a direct bearing on the killing of people like Marikana. So I think his analysis now, it's not that people are going back. I think our younger generation now know what they've missed in their school years. In the high school curriculum, there is a portion that's devoted to Steve Biko. It's taught in a very matter-of-fact way. We have a Biko education project here at the university, at the Center for Critical Research on Race and Identity. We work with high school teachers from our local community, from rural communities, from the township, to make a concerted effort to work with people to make sure that the teaching of BICO takes on a much more insightful, a much more rigorous focus, and not just teaching as somebody who kind of lived and died. I think the meaning of Steve BICO today in terms of black consciousness, you know, the black consciousness movement of Azania, Sasso, was formed here at our medical school in Durban. And students now have to come to terms with the ways in which just all of the things that they were expecting to happen in the last 20 years just did not happen. And so I think you know, when I say going back to BICO, I mean for our students being able to get access to I Write What I Like, which is a collection of his works, and being able to grapple with, you know, why was BICO regarded as being so fierce? What is it about being very particular about how he chose his language? What was it about him, you know, in terms of looking at how the historical development of racism and capitalism in South Africa? And those are key issues in the education, the training, the scholarship, the vision of young people in the country and around the world. So, I mean, I'm somebody, I teach BICO, I work with several organizations in philosophy, critical race theory, around the world, and I make it my duty and my responsibility to make sure that when people talk about post-colonial and anti-colonial and decolonial thinkers, that they not forget that particular tradition of anti-colonial thinkers, which is not about the individual, but it's about the nation, it's about nationalism, and it's also about the history of colonialism globally, not just in one particular region.
So, taking off from what you just said, let me come back to Kolela Manku. I mean, I think that what as we hear Rosanna speak about where we are now and the legacy of Stephen Biko, and we see what's going on with the mine workers breaking away, the kind of political movements that are kind of rumbling up, even though maybe a large number or majority of young people don't know who BICO was, something is kind of coming up from the bottom, and how that kind of legacy of BICO and especially the analysis, do you think it's fueling something new in South Africa now, Kolela?
Oh, yes. You know what? I mean, the paradox of the South African situation is that there are many, many, I mean, on the ground, in terms of young people, in terms of workers, there is this yearning for BICO. It's an incredible thing, actually, you know, that almost everybody in South Africa speaks about BICO. And yet, you have a government that is finds itself unable to embrace that, because you see, as the speaker before me was saying, right, she's teaching a BICO at the University of Natal. I teach BICO at the University of Cape Town, right? But what you do not have is a national kind of like an institution that is devoted not just to BICO, by the way, and not just to Mandela, whom we hear about all the time, but to the whole cultural patrimony of South Africa, that there's a history that stretches 200 years of black people since their encounter with colonialism, writing in the 1800s, newspaper articles, writing books about how to actually deal with these issues of race. And part of the reason why I'm here at the Du Bois Institute at Harvard is to kind of compare notes with the African-American experience. In South Africa, you do not have anything of that order where the nation as a whole says this is our cultural patrimony. And for me, that is the most painful thing. Because there are people like Robert Sobukwe who comes before Biko. Because Biko is inspired by Sobukwe. But when you look, I mean, I did an article for Transition magazine where I've kind of like, you know, enumerated this history. And I do so also in my book. But it's very, very important that our children have a sense of this history. But as it is now, it's a hodgepodge situation of individuals doing these things, you know, as and when and they can. So you know, and what this has done is, if you don't have a sense of your history, what happens is that not only you don't have any platform to move from, and because you don't have any platform to move from, you move from the platform of other people. So I teach, for example, sociology. When I teach my students, I got to University of Cape Town. I said, okay, you know what? We have the European social theorists. We have Karl Marx. We have Max Weber and Durkheim. And when I started introducing African intellectuals, it just changed the students. And they love it because it gives them, particularly the black students, it gives them a sense that they can now locate themselves within these institutions. They can say, ha, we also have something to contribute. And what that does is it creates creativity. Then they start thinking about biographies. They start thinking about movies, about documentaries, and all of that. But for as long as you do not have a governmental or a national initiative, it's a long, long way to go still.
Could I please add on, or perhaps just say something in terms of the previous speaker?
Sure, then I'm going to get to our other guests as well. But go ahead, Rosanna, please, yes.
Sorry, I just want to say to the previous speaker, it's so important, what you mentioned about being at the Du Bois Institute. On Monday, because, you know, we had all sorts of incidents this week, so we shifted our Biko Commemoration Day to Monday. Dr. Mugwape is coming to talk to our students, and also Professor Sipho Tshabalala, you know, from the PAC, he's coming as well. We've had lots of days on Robert Sobukwe. Mrs. Sobukwe is living in poverty in Graaff-Reinet.
That's correct.
You know, we're trying to organize a bus to go and visit her. And, you know, the ANC has had no contact with her. And I think what the comrade before me was saying, it's, I think people are going, our young students are going to Biko because there are people like us who are showing them the importance of it and saying to them, this is not only important in terms of South African history, but Biko also read very widely. He read Amy Césaire, you know, he read Hegel, he read Marx, he read Jaspers. You know, he read a series of other people. He read people from the Black Panthers. And so as we look at 20 years post the first democratic elections, we have to ask ourselves questions as scholars and educators. What did Du Bois' double consciousness mean now when we have black policemen shooting black workers in the back, chasing them down when the protest was already over? So I think again, you know, in terms of your program that you're running today, in terms of my comrade, the previous speaker, there hasn't been a more important time than now for us to delve into the work of Steve Biko, his life history, what he had to say, his message, and to make sure that we encourage and educate our students broadly and to look at those kinds of overlaps internationally.
You know, what all three of you are saying is kind of critically important, and I'm curious about, you know, one of the things people speculate about when you look at Cyril Ramaphosa, who was a revolutionary leader who's now a millionaire and is running the mines, these where the mine workers that you were just referring to were killed, and may become the next president of South Africa, next leader of South Africa. And you look at other revolutionaries who kind of in the ANC when they took over really became kind of a party where people kind of made millions of dollars and had to acquiesce in some ways, people say, to international capital because of what they were confronted by. And we can argue that back and forth. But the question is, so where would you think, and this is total speculation, but when we think of that, and Stephen Biko died young, Frantz Fanon died young, what we think that might have happened to Stephen Biko and what would make him different than the others? Do you know what I'm asking? I mean, it's speculative, I know, but I think people ask this question a great deal.
Mark?
Yes. Adrian, go ahead.
I'd like to say a couple of things. I think Biko and his legacy is a victim of South Africa's negotiated settlement. We've successfully, whitewashed him out of our media. And I think media like Bush Radio, independent media like Bush Radio, plays a role in helping to rebuild that. And it's important that, my colleagues are saying, they're introducing these Biko to students at university level. But it starts beyond that. It starts earlier than that as well. Hence, we have programs and encourage discussion on air constantly around social issues. And I'd like to say that as much as I might have sounded negative in the beginning, there are Bikos out there. Young people who are now using the technology to raise their issues, using platforms, social media platforms, etc., to raise the issue, raise various issues. And that, that disgruntled feeling that we, 1994 came and went and we didn't, some of us feel we're not much better off. They are raising these concerns, but it's not being made known in the mainstream media. We wait until Americana. These Americana is not a new thing. It was boiling up for a long, long time. Before our mainstream media got to those issues. I think going back to your question of where would Biko be right now, I hope not like many of our other leaders. but unfortunately, I mean, when it came to black consciousness, I'd like to quote Biko himself by saying, being black is not a matter of pigmentation. Being black is a reflection of a mental attitude. As soon as you describe yourself as black in this country, it's a big deal. It's a big, big deal. Whether you from mixed background, it's a big, big deal, as my colleague from the university said. But it's a way of emancipating yourself. And I think that's what scares a lot of people in this country about Biko and about concepts that he promoted. But what a lot of young people are doing, and what we as educators and as media professionals and broadcasters, radio, TV, etc., need to do is encourage the principles of Stephen Biko. What did he do as a person? He read extensively, as my colleague mentioned. He also, besides, sitting in his hostel room or sitting in his room and having all these thoughts flood in his head, he engaged. He engaged with his colleagues. He challenged, he engaged, and he built up his own resources. And then at the end, he acted. And I think those three things, reading, engaging, and actually doing, is what a lot of young people are trying to do. I think we as the people remembering him and holding on to this legacy, we need to encourage that, and we need to help hold their hand and walk with them, not lead them. They are their own leaders, as Biko taught us.
I think that's happening here as well in America. For those of us who were part of the struggle in the 60s and the 70s here in the United States, and we see these young people coming up in their 20s who do know who Stephen Biko is and who was and have read Fanon and will be reading others, we hope, and that I think the older ones have to kind of not give way, but to understand that young leadership has to be there. And I think that's a very important piece, especially given the age Stephen Biko was when he died, or and many of the great leaders were. Let me try to get one very quick call. We only have like 6 minutes left in our segment here, and you have, all three have so much to say. We hope we can reprise this again sometime in the near future. But Max Obuchevsky just called in, who was a leader of the anti-apartheid struggle here in Baltimore, where we were broadcasting from. Max, we only have a couple of minutes, but please come in.
Sure. Welcome, everyone. I was a Peace Corps volunteer heading to Botswana with my group 10 days after Steve Biko was killed. I was following the struggle from the United States. And when we arrived at the airport in Johannesburg, the military had control of the airport, which I found fascinating. And even more fascinating to me is they were going through our luggage and they were looking for porno magazines. Penthouse, Playboy, whatever. They had the wrong group for that. I also think it's important to raise this issue. There's a great film, great documentary, Searching for Sugar Man.
Yes.
Which details the sexual repression in South Africa. We would get any movies that came to Botswana, they'd come through South Africa. There was censorship of the films. I had to see a lot of movies back here in the United States to see them. And sadly, if anyone hasn't seen or heard of Searching for Sugar Man,
right,
the director of the movie actually killed himself. So those are some of the points I wanted to raise. I'm glad to hear what people are saying. We have to remember Steve Biko. Denzel Washington, as you know, played him.
Right.
There's a great music, and I appreciate the opportunity to have shared this with you and your audience.
Thank you so much, Max. We literally have like 3 minutes left in our segment, so a very short, quick closing thoughts. We promise to have you all back. Rosanna Mart?
I think it's very important, as the previous speaker said, about, you know, like I said, we do have programs where we also go out to high schools and communities around in the area. There's often an assumption that the people who would be interested in Steve Biko are people who can read and write and not people who are either very young and very old. I think the importance of the message today is that to remember Steve Biko trained as a medical doctor. He started a community clinic, but his heart and soul was among the community. It wasn't about university. It wasn't about the kind of education that we see that's happening in the country now, but it was understanding the very most important part of Black consciousness, and that was the mind. And if we are adults by definition, we should be able to teach the youngest person and the oldest person that message.
Khulela Manku, a closing thought.
If only we could have a national institution in South Africa that takes care of our cultural history and our cultural patrimony, like you guys have in the United, you know, the Smithsonian Institution, where you have, for example, a museum of African American history. I mean, given our history, we would assume that we would have institutions like that in South Africa, and we don't. It is time that we get serious about our history as a way of imagining our way into the future. It's 20 years into our democracy, and we still live in a colonial culture. It's incredible. And so my own wish is that something could happen that would honor Biko in a much more institutional way, where all these young people can find way to come together and talk about ideas. And that won't happen in the ANC. That won't happen in political parties. It has to happen in some kind of institution. And that's what I'm trying all the time to be thinking about. How does one go about that? Where do we get the money for that? Who do we collaborate with? For me, that is the main institutional challenge if we are to preserve Biko's legacy and memory.
And Adrian Lowe, we have maybe less than a minute. I'm sorry.
I would like to encourage young people specifically to read, engage, and do. That is my wish. And I think they are trying, and we will get there. I believe South Africans and South African young people are a positive group of people.
Adrian Lowe, thank you. And Dr. Khulela Manku, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Rosanna Mart, thank you so much for joining us. We will be linking to all of our guests' work to see what they've been doing. and what they've been writing, and we look forward to having them back on with us again. And thank you all so much for helping us remember and look forward to Stephen Biko and what his legacy means. Thank you.
Well, thank you for keeping him in the international consciousness.
Thank you all so much. All right, we're going out with a bit more remembrance here, Stephen Biko by song, and I want to thank you all so much for joining us here on this remembrance of Stephen Biko, one of the most important figures in our world and life. So we'll take a brief break, and we will return in a moment with our next segment. Because America up in the red Indian, tell him Africa.